in just a few seconds. So welcome, each and every one of you, to the QB board meeting.
Hi, Tom.
It was a long week and a relatively long weekend for many of us as we watched the legislature finish their work on time.
Did they finish?
Quote unquote.
It was a comedy, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'm trying to be serious here for once in my life. So.
That's a struggle for Dave.
I know it is. It absolutely is. Let's move then to adoption of the consent agenda. You will also see the March meeting minutes in your packet and, of course, the agenda. If you would desire for me to read the minutes of the March 18th meeting, I could do that, but I'll bet you don't. And so at some point here, someone could offer a motion to approve both. There is a motion. Is there a second, to the motion? There is a second. Further discussion on the motion to approve both the agenda and the March minutes. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. I have a couple of introductions I would like to make today. And the first is our new intern, Jessica Beske. Jessica, maybe you want to stand up and let folks know who you are, particularly those that are behind you. And we welcome Jessica. Jessica is a senior this year at the University of Minnesota and is hopeful of finishing her degree. And much of your focus, I believe, is on environmental review. And so I think the world needs more people to do environmental review. So thank you for that. And welcome to the EQB structure, and also welcome to your first meeting. The second introduction I would like to make is Elizabeth Jupesta. And Elizabeth, if you would stand, she joins us from Malaysia.
Indonesia.
Yeah, that's what it says right here. Yeah. She joins us from Norway. No. I'm sorry. And is a fellow who joins us as a fellow from the U.S. State Department American Council on Young Political Leaders. And so, again, you'll hear from Elizabeth in a few minutes. So thank you very much, Elizabeth. And you'll be here for what? Will
one more week.
One more week, okay. Have no other, nothing else to report, so I'm going to ask Will for his director's report. Will.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things, brief legislative update. You know, as you all know, that regular session adjourned on the 18th. All the provisions that impact the board were contained in the environment and natural resources and agriculture budget that was passed. Despite a $62 million reduction to the target in our area, the board's budget was held harmless, and it was augmented with a 1.8% operational bump that was across the board for all agencies. So that's a positive. A couple policy provisions to be aware of. You recall at our last meeting, some citizens were concerned about the expiration of an environmental review sunset. The threshold was going to sunset on July 1. We were able to extend that to stay in effect until our rulemaking is complete. So that should alleviate some concerns that the public had on that particular rulemaking. And then one other provision that was added into the environmental review or into the environmental budget bill was for the board to promulgate rules with a good cause exemption for the following. And these projects would now be exempted from doing EAWs. Constructing a recreational trail less than 25 miles long on forested or other naturally vegetated land for recreational use. Adding a new motorized recreational use or a seasonal motorized recreational use to an existing motorized recreational trail if the treadway width is not expanded as a result of the added use. and designating an existing legally constructed route, such as a logging road for motorized recreational trail use. So if the bill is enacted and signed, we will move forward with that. But we have good cause exemption, so it'll be pretty quick rulemaking. Another thing I want to call your attention to, if you look in front of you, there is a proposal that we've been working on with Management Analysis Division folks at MMB. As you recall, the board participated in a strategic planning effort facilitated by the Governor's Institute on Community Design a couple of years back. What this effort is trying to do is to look back over lessons learned over the last couple of years and really try to better operationalize some of our work. I think we're pretty unique in that we manage more in-kind resources than we do resources that are actually appropriated to us, and we want to ensure that we are doing so in a way that is efficient and really can quickly move forward on broad priorities as they are directed. So you all will be contacted by MMB individually, but also if you have comments or concerns or questions, things you want to do to modify the scope or anything else, please feel free to share it with me and or a Management Analysis Division folks once this gets started. But we're hoping to move forward pretty quickly because it'll be supported by FY15 and FY16 dollars. Other than that, we will not be meeting in June, and that's all that I have, Mr. Chairman.
You want to introduce?
Sure. Yep. Thank you. Well, just to introduce Elizabeth briefly, she's been with us since the beginning of the month. She joined us as a professional fellow with the American Council of Young Political Leaders, ACYPL program. ACYPL was recently awarded a U.S. State Department grant to implement a professional fellows program around the theme of legislative process and governance for fellows from Indonesia, Malaysia, Myanmar, Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam as part of President Obama's Young Southeast Asian Leaders Program. While in the U.S., each participant will take a part in a month-long fellowship in a professional office and will work on an individual project that she will implement in their home communities upon their return. Many of you and your staffs have spent time with Elizabeth over the course of the month discussing the work of your agencies, important issues, etc. Thank you. Thank you for your support. And with that, I'd like to welcome Elizabeth to make a presentation to the board.
Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Chair Frederickson and EQB members. I am delighted to be here today, and in this opportunity, I will like to talk and share about the Indonesia and an overview and its issue on the deforestation and climate change. It is a great concern to our people, and I'm sure it is a great concern to the entire world as well. I will begin today by giving an overview of Indonesia, including the forest sector, and then move to the deforestation issue and then to the climate change status. Indonesia is an island state which consists of 17,800 islands, but only about 6,000 of them are inhabited by people. The capital city is Jakarta, which is located in Java Island, and Java Island is the most populous island in Indonesia, which consists of 150 million people. As a comparison, Java Island has the same size with the New York State. Indonesia is located in between of the Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean, and also in between of the Asian continents and Australia continents. It is passed by the equatorial line. In terms of population, there are almost 250 million people in Indonesia, and it makes Indonesia as the fourth most populous country in the world. Indonesia is the country with the largest Muslim population, with 86% of its population is Muslim. Religions play an important role within society and daily lives of the people in Indonesia. With this broad range of population, there are lots of culture, language, and religions and tradition. The national motto of Indonesia is Bhinneka Tunggal Ika, which means unity in diversity, that despite all the differences in multicultural society, there is a true sense of unity among the Indonesian people. Indonesia declared its independence in 1945, that was colonized before by Portuguese, Dutch, English, and Japanese during the World War II. In terms of health, life expectancy in Indonesia is around 69 years. The Indonesian government type is republic with multi-party system. In 2014 election, there were about 12 political parties contesting for the national election. And the president is directly elected by people and has fully authority for the executive power. The president is elected for a 5-year terms and maximum can serve for 2 periods. The legislative power is vested in 2 legislative bodies, which are the House of People Representative and the Regional Representative Council. However, between those 2 legislative bodies, the House of Representatives has the power to pass the budget, to pass legislation and draft, and also to oversee the executive government, while the Regional Representative Council has a more limited mandate. Judicial power is vested in the Supreme Court, which is independent from the executive and legislative. Indonesia's economy has grown strongly since 2010. During the global financial crisis, Indonesia outperformed its regional neighbors and joined China and India as the only G20 members posting growth. However, Indonesia still struggles with poverty, unemployment, corruption practice, and a complex regulatory environment. Now we are move on to the forest sector. For the forest sector, Indonesia is a home of the most extensive forest land in the world and also considered as one of the world's richest forests in terms of biodiversity. Indonesia forest land comprises 60% of the total country land area, which makes it as the third largest area for the tropical rainforest in the world. Therefore, the tropical rainforest in Indonesia is important not only for the national economy and local livelihoods, but also for the global environment. Over the last 5 decades, the forest plays a large part for the Indonesia economic development. Most people in Indonesia are still highly dependent on the forest for agriculture and for their livelihoods. The forest industry has expanded from a local lumber business into the international competitive sector. It contributes approximately $21 billion to Indonesian GDP, or roughly 3.5% to the national revenue. And speaking about deforestation, according to the last report from Indonesian Ministry of Forestry, in between of 2009 to 2011, Indonesia lost about 1.24 million hectares of its forests, mainly in Kalimantan and Sumatra area. Deforestation mainly caused by agriculture expansion, uncontrolled illegal or illegal logging, over-exploitation in mining, forest fires, conversion of forests to become plantation, and infrastructure development. And apart from those, there are also few underlying causes of deforestation, such as the poor governance at all levels, a huge corrupt practice, and weak protection of communities' rights. There is a lack of institution capabilities also that affects deforestation. And ineffective law enforcement and control also take part of the deforestation. Another cause is high global demand for timber and palm oil, which results in clearance of forests for plantation. Climate change in Indonesia greatly affects many aspects of the country, not just economy sector, and also cause pollution, soil erosion, floods, loss of biodiversity, and increase in global warming. Deforestation is also considered to be one of the contributing factors to global climate change. Regarding the climate change, Indonesia is the third largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world and has been identified as one of the most vulnerable countries in the face of climate change. Annual temperature has increased by about 0.3 degrees Celsius. The sea level increase also for the extreme weather condition and warming temperatures and change in ocean circulation. Rainfall decreased during critical times, of which may translate into high risk of drought, uncertain water availability, and consequently uncertain ability to produce agriculture or food. According to the report from the Minister of Environment, in the last three decades, 80% of natural disaster in Indonesia is caused by the climate change. And the impact of the climate change is somewhat noticeable but may not be aware by the people. Further to this, most climate scientists will agree that the main cause of the current global warming trend is the human expansion of the greenhouse gas emission, which is known as a greenhouse effect. At the global level, 57% of greenhouse gas emissions originate from fossil fuel combustion. However, unlike China, India, and the US, most of Indonesia emissions do not originate from the industrial activities of fossil fuel combustion. In fact, 73% of the total emissions that produced are from the peatland, which the majority caused by the fires, and also from the land use chains and forestry. The government of Indonesia knows how important action against climate change for their own country and people, thus it has put lots of effort and attention to this issue. In 2011, the Indonesia established the National Action Plan that addressing climate change and has included the rehabilitation of forests and as one of the programs. This regulation is prepared as a follow-up action of the Indonesia commitment, which was presented by the President at G20 Summit in Pittsburgh on 2009. The target is to reduce the greenhouse gas emission by 26% with domestic efforts and 41% with the domestic efforts and support by the international by 2020. Currently, Indonesia has achieved 10% reduction in greenhouse gas emission, and the country is still on track to meet its reduction goals. Apart from that, there are also a number of laws that has been issued, including the law for guidance on reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, or known as a REDD, and also to establish Indonesia Climate Change Center. The current president of Indonesia has just extended the moratorium on new license to log or clear the rainforest, which call as the Indonesia Flexi Forest Policy. A new climate change policy and action plan for 2015 to 2019 has been set up, including programs for mainstreaming of sustainable development policy, improving capacity building across sectors and at all levels, also to enhance transparency and accountability, and for manage natural resources assets sustainably and to secure the ecosystem and safe biodiversity. The United States, through USAID, is working with Indonesia on a wide range of activities to hedge fund low-carbon growth and address major threats to the world's environment. There are a few programs that are currently ongoing, such as Millennium Challenge Corporation, that to implement a green prosperity project and promoting environmental sustainable economic growth. Also, with the support of the U.S., Indonesia government established Indonesia Climate Change Center in order to strengthen the climate change policy, mapping, monitoring of carbon-rich peat plants and tropical forests. Indonesia and the U.S. government signed the agreement for the Tropical Forest Conservation Act agreement to conserve the tropical forest in 2012. Moving forward on SOLUCI. SOLUCI is a new program that just launched by the USAID for management of forests, marine resources, and clean energy. John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State, in his visit to Indonesia last year, has urged the global community to act against climate change. Kerry, in his speech, mentioned that climate change perhaps the world's most fearsome weapons of mass destruction. It is because the climate change will destroy ecosystems, create greater human health risks, and also threaten global livelihoods. Indonesia has acknowledged the threats and is attempting to do its part in the fight against climate change. As the climate change is a global concern and the needs to be addressed globally and collaboratively for it to be effectively handled. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth. Do you have questions for Elizabeth? Adam? No?
Go ahead.
I didn't have one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say that I'm really glad that the EQB is and grateful to the staff who have been hosting Elizabeth this month. I was a delegate, I guess you would say, to an ACYPL program in Indonesia in 2009. So I got to spend 9 days there. And I think the thing that I most left with is sort of amazing statistics about Indonesia being the fourth largest population, its third largest contributor to climate change, largest Muslim majority country, just really an amazing impact in the world in terms of size and scope and climate and biodiversity and diversity within in the people of Indonesia. And so my question is, I'd be curious, thank you for sharing about your country and what's happening there. What are some things that, what stood out that you've learned while being at the EQB and that you're planning to take back with you when you return home?
Yes, it has been a great experience for me so far to do my fellowship program with the EQB, and I learned a lot about the environmental system, especially in Minnesota, and also its regulation and coordination among the agencies, because the EQB made up by 9 agencies, and which is I can see that the coordination among the agency, I would say, is really systematically and very transparent. That's the 2 values that I can bring back to my home country, and also the process of the environmental review and how the Minnesota they impose the obligation for the environmental review, and also how the people value the environmental review itself is things for me that really outstanding that I can bring to Indonesia.
Other questions for Elizabeth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Elizabeth, you mentioned that logging is key to your economy. I think you said 3.5% of your country's GDP is logging. You also split that out that there's legal and illegal logging going on. If we just look at the legal component, is the legal component of logging being done under any certification? In the United States, I don't know if you're familiar, we have different certification agencies that certify that our logging practices are done environmentally sustainable. I'm just wondering if your logging industry has adopted any of those practices.
Yeah, the legal logging practice in Indonesia is based on the license they issued by the Ministry of Environment. However, the enforcement, the monitoring is still lacking by the government, and thus there are so many companies, the logging companies, they abuse their license by doing something that beyond the permit.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, Elizabeth, we'll miss you next week. Thank you for you're leaving in a week for home, and I hope that you're able to take away some very positive experiences from your time here in Minnesota, and you're always welcome to come back. So thank you very much. Our next item on the agenda is a designation of responsible governmental unit for environmental review, and I will ask Courtney to come on up and present, please. Welcome, Courtney.
Good afternoon. I'm going to pull up a presentation, so if I take one moment. Mr. Chair and board members, I bring before you an opportunity to designate a different responsible governmental unit for the Owatonna Energy Station. And for the record, I should introduce myself. I am Courtney Allers Nelson, and I am working in the area of environmental review for the EQB. So just to start out with some general background, which you will have found in the resolution findings and order, which we also printed and made available for you today. Just so you know, the electronic document that you received was correct, but when we printed the document, for some reason, there was an error. So again, you'll find the correct document provided for you today at your seat. So again, just to start out with some background, the Owatonna Energy Station is a project that would be located in Owatonna, Minnesota. It's a new power plant, and the construction of the new power plant is going to include four new natural gas electric generating units. Collectively, it'll have a capacity of approximately 40 megawatts. So that's in between a 25 and 50 megawatt unit, which is important as we find out which area of environmental review is necessary. For the construction and operation of the power plant, permits are going to be required. The MPCA will be issuing at least two different permits, including a Title V air emissions permit. They have the federally delegated authority to issue both air and water quality permits for this facility. When the project was originally proposed in the fall of 2014, we identified that two different mandatory categories for an environmental assessment worksheet would be triggered. On bullet number two, you see the two categories there. Electric generating facilities, again, for any facility between 25 and 50 megawatts, which this facility will be, and for air pollution. At the time, we assumed that given the size and the nature of this facility, it would be emitting more than 100,000 tons of greenhouse gases annually. Therefore, that second category would be triggered. As a result, two different RGUs were identified. The MPCA was identified as the RGU for the air pollution category, and the EQB was identified as the RGU for the electric generating facility category. So following 4410, EQB and MPCA agreed that MPCA would be the appropriate RGU in this situation. They have both approval authority, expertise in this area, and experience with these sorts of projects. However, as they began working with the project proposer and as they began drafting this Title V air emissions permit, they realized that the facility will no longer emit 100,000 tons of greenhouse gases. Therefore, that category for air pollution was no longer met. As a result, the remaining RGU identified for the project was the EQB. After months of working on this environmental assessment worksheet and working with the project proposers, it was really clear that they had made some progress. So the MPCA requested that the EQB assign a different RGU for this project. That is why I'm before you today. The MPCA has indicated that they would like to continue to finish this project for a number of reasons. One, significant work has been done already on the EAW, and again, after months of work on that, we don't want to impede progress. They also, as I said already, have the greatest expertise. They are the air folks, and they certainly have that authority to issue a Title V air emissions permit, which the EQB, for example, does not. They have the experience with the project, as again, they've worked with them for several months, and the expertise in these project areas. So It is my recommendation that this board determine that the MPCA be the RGU for the Owatonna Energy Station project.
Thank you very much, Courtney. You've heard the presentation. In your packet, you will find the conclusion of law and a sample copy of the order based on the finding of fact, conclusion, and the entire record of this proceeding. The Minnesota Environmental Quality Board hereby makes the following, and point number 32 would be the order. Is there a motion to approve the order?
So move.
There is. Is there a second?
Second.
There is, and I believe a roll call is required.
Commissioner Mossman?
Aye.
Ms. Ide-Tolleson?
Aye.
Commissioner Ellinger?
Aye.
Commissioner Fredrickson?
Aye.
Ms. Gehring?
Aye.
Ms. Knuth?
Aye.
Commissioner Lammer?
Aye.
Commissioner Napstad?
Aye.
Commissioner Rothman?
Aye.
Mr. Saxog?
Aye.
Commissioner Linkstein?
Aye.
Mr. Tomlinson?
Aye.
The motion prevails. So ordered. Let's go then to the next item, and the next item on the agenda is EQB website mitigation update, and our presenter is Meg Eichens. Welcome, Meg, and thank you, Courtney. Did I say mitigate as opposed to migrate? I've been mitigating for the last few weeks. So, yeah. Mitigating wetlands, Tom. I'm sorry. The migration.
And while Megan's
migrating some also.
Commissioner, while Megan's getting set up, I might turn it over to Kristen and John. They just had some updates on some citizen engagement work that they've been participating in, and my apologies for not recognizing you during my report earlier.
Well, thank you, Kristen Ide-Tolleson. I'll be really quick. I just wanted to publicly thank Will and Eric Dahl for arranging for a really great presentation at a citizen-organized Silica Sand Conference in Lake City, Minnesota, on May 9th. It covered a lot of territory on environmental review, updated people on the silica sand rules, and all in all was a great educational outreach and very timely for Southeast Minnesota. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, Will asked me to talk a little bit about a couple of meetings that I've attended recently, and these have to do with what's called Climate Minnesota, Local Stories, Community Solutions. And these have been held throughout the state in 12 different cities. They've held the first four, and eight more will be held in September. Anna Henderson briefed us on these back in February. And it really is an opportunity for us to share in a partnership, gives us some leverage out there in terms of climate change. These were conducted by the Climate Generation, a Will Steger legacy, which is the new name, the redesignation of the former Will Steger Foundation, and the U of M's Regional Sustainable Development Partnership. And they've been funded by the Minnesota Environmental Natural Resources Trust Fund, the McKnight Foundation, and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, I believe. Thank you, John. And LAL Designs. And I guess in terms of the EQB, we have been supportive of this. We have partnered with it. And a great thing about it is the two I attended, one in Duluth and one in Burnsville, they had our document, our climate change document, prominently displayed at the check-in desk. They were enthusiastically handing it out. And we also, our logo was also prominent in some of the materials. So it was a very interesting session both times. I think one of the things I came away with is they emphasized that we are the climate change generation. And when they say we, that's everybody that's alive today. It's not the old people who are to blame for it. It's not the young people that are going to inherit the problem. We're all responsible and need to be engaged with what's happening. The goal of these meetings is to increase climate literacy. And they began also with the meetings with a presentation, a scientific presentation. In Duluth, this was Mark Seeley. And I know the board is familiar with Mark Seeley. We've heard him on several occasions. And I think he's one of the foremost speakers in Minnesota in terms of presenting the scientific numbers on climate change. That goes into what's called a storytelling panel. And in the case of Burnsville, Andy Holdsworth was one of the presenters. He told a story on climate adaptation. And then from there, it goes into solutions workshops, where the various participants break out, go into sessions, and talk about some of the solutions, community-based solutions, that can affect climate mitigation and climate adaptation for specific communities. It's really a community-based presentation, place-based. And to that, both sessions were introduced by the mayors. In both Burnsville, and we know Duluth with Don Ness, are communities that are very involved in climate mitigation and climate adaptation. So I just would like to encourage the board members and anybody else to attend these sessions. They'll be starting up again in September throughout the state. It's a very valuable experience, and it would be great to have an EQB presence at these meetings. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, John. Questions for either Kristen or John?
How do we find the dates, John?
I've got them here, if you'd like. They're in September.
We can circulate them by email.
Give them a will, and we can get them out.
Great.
Thank you.
Just one more, please. They were very well done, very interesting. It's a great organization that's putting them on.
Thank you. Megan, back to you. Let's mitigate here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the board. I'm an EQB staff member, Megan Eichen, and I'm leading the communications efforts for the EQB. Over the course of the past year or so, I've been working on an overhaul of the EQB website. Early last year, we began to work with Minute to convert the content from a homegrown website that was housed at MinGeo into a content management system called Drupal. That will allow for more functionality and better usability. One of the main advantages of Drupal is that it allows the staff to be able to edit and to be able to use open source coding for this project. Texts, photos, and documents can be edited much more simply, and we were one of the first state agencies to go to this platform. I'm happy to go through anything on the live site after the presentation if you have any questions. The process of moving the old content into a new system began in February of last year. I worked with Minute here at the PCA to begin to convert the content and create the new look and feel for the site. In August, we launched the new site with the help of Wayne Loftus, Rick Newquist of Minute, and Paul Andre from the PCA communications staff, all of whom who have been very invaluable to this project. We have also been bound by some limitations and have had to focus our efforts to get the most out of the time and resources available. As the website evolves, we may have the opportunity for more development work to be done. The goal has been to take the content migrated from the old site and key in on improvements that would make the most significant strides forward. Next, I worked with a developer to improve the user experience and functionality of the site. And on April 1st of this year, we launched the new version of the EQB website that is live right now. I'm going to briefly walk you through some of the more important and major changes that we made to the site. Webcasting.
That's an improvement?
Now we need some mitigation.
It's celebrity.
We need to mitigate that, I believe.
Will do. Webcasting, as you know, anyone interested who wants to find out more about the EQB and what we are doing, we hold a meeting every month, and now it's broadcast on the website. PCA Communications has allowed us to share the hosting of these files and create an archive going back 6 months. Eric Dahl, who's in the control room right now, and I are being trained in on the equipment to shoot and record these meetings, which then link from the site. Our last full board meeting in March on the topic of pipelines had a total of 73 views, 30 live views as the meeting was happening, and 43 from people who accessed the archived file. The Silica Sand Ordinance Library is also another main focus of this. The library has been relocated and retooled from a static list of ordinances and links to documents into a more dynamic database
with search capabilities and categories to sort by. Users are now able to sort by location, government unit, or by the topic of interest. On the content side, we are also able to put new entries into the database and tag each one appropriately as it grows, so the body information continues to be expanded and become more useful. The EQB monitor has made some great strides as well. Take a look at the navigation here. This is what the monitor section in the old website looked like. We now have a better search function, a call out on the right-hand side for upcoming deadlines, and search functionality so documents can be sorted by date of publication. We have a form for monitor submittals, which makes the acceptance or rejection process easier for staff, as government units have a more structured way to enter in the information. There are also automatic email responses set up to go out from the system, alerting them that their entry has been received and whether or not it has been accepted or rejected, plus contact information if they need it. The intent of this functionality is to save time from both a staff and from a local government perspective. Another example of overall improvements is the addition of photos to many aspects of the site, including the slider on the front page, as well as the contact section that you see here. This breaks up the text and makes things much more user-friendly. Drupal, the content management system that we're using, allows us to take advantage of what's called responsive design. This is a website's ability to adapt the type of device that the site is being accessed through, whether it be a PC, a tablet, a cell phone, or some other device. We've created the site with this functionality in mind so that when you view this website on different size screens, the size adjusts accordingly. In April, Google began figuring mobile friendliness into its page rank, meaning that sites that are more mobile friendly get higher results in the search engine. We've tested the functionality of our site and it passes the test. If you search for Environmental Quality Board on a Google website, this is the first site that shows up. And just to briefly touch on a few other highlights, the search engine of the actual site itself has been improved. The user can now access information in a much more visual way. And there's more functionality in the site, including the use of calendar and customized contact forms. The site is also much more easily updated from a program perspective from the staff with the use of a dashboard that we developed and customized for our site. And finally, we have incorporated Google Analytics, which is an industry standard across the whole website. Special code is embedded into the structure that pulls all traffic statistics into a dashboard that looks very much like this. I am able to pull information about what pages are being accessed, when they are accessed, and from where with what type of technology. Just a quick snapshot of analytics from April 1st, the date of launch, to May 15th. The site had 1,638 users over this period of time. And as you can see, the page view breakdown, topics for environmental review make up the top three of the top five most viewed pages of the site, including environmental review homepage, the monitor, and guidance for practitioners and proposers. There are a number of things that the EQB will continue to address to get the most value from our new website platform. As the CZO process comes to a close, we will be posting information there later this year when numbers and documents are more finalized. The water report, which you will hear about later in this meeting, will also be something that we use as a base to revamp the water program part of our website. There are additional improvements to some of the existing items that we have. For example, can we embed the webcast to create a more cohesive feel to the website? And another question is, do we have enough resources and bandwidth to tackle social media platforms such as Twitter? All this while Minute continues to update the site with security protocols and function, and we hope to continue to work with them. Just a quick mention of the other website that the EQB launched in February, climatechangemn.org. This is an electronic version of the program of the print document that we created last year. Not only did our agencies participate in the launch by promoting it via social media, emails, and website links, the governor's office sent out a gov delivery notice that the site had launched. Since launch, more than 3,000 people have accessed the content, and our executive director was interviewed by Fox 9 after the launch to talk about its significance. The site includes a print-friendly version of the document and segments of the document broken down by topic for people to print specific information that they'd like to highlight. We've made some great improvements on the website from where we began just a little more than a year ago. Cross-agency collaboration has been essential in this project and has led to a more user-friendly and functional content. It will continue to evolve and improve as we move forward, and we have more work to do here at the EQB as we take on new projects and find better ways to communicate the mission and information we want to with the public. So if anybody has any questions for me, I'm happy to pull it up.
Megan. Congratulations, Megan, for a great change in the website. The numbers appear to be really strong. I don't know what our former website generated, but I'm guessing that your numbers are much better. And so how about feedback? Are you getting any feedback at all from any of the users?
Nothing yet. We're getting some internal feedback about things that people are missing from the old website that they'd like us to bring back or make sure that we highlight, and some good feedback today from the citizen members.
Questions?
Eric? Mr. Chair? Megan, as we were looking at that monitor submission form, have you, maybe Commissioner Fredrickson's question had this too, but have you received any feedback on how that is for the user when they're submitting?
We've only received a couple items through that form so far, and we're still kind of getting people used to the fact that it's there. So we haven't received any comments whether or not they have a problem with it or whether it's great, but we'll keep you posted if we do.
Okay. So I'm kind of curious, just because you mentioned there's notification it gets rejected. So I was just curious if there was a percent rejection or anything, if there's only two.
No, there's not.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Megan, you had indicated that I think it was on one of the reports that was listed on here that you had been able to count the number of looks, and you said from where. You can tell from where. I wonder if you could clarify on what from where means. Is that from what state, what city? Can you add some clarity?
From where
to
that? Can mean a lot of things. It can mean from what state, what part of the world. It can also mean where the traffic is coming from, if it's coming from some sort of a search, if it's coming from another state agency. If it came from that gov delivery, we can tell where the traffic is coming from via the report as well.
Can it tell if it's coming from my house?
It probably could, but I don't have access to that information, Mr. Chair.
Only the FBI.
So, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to look on the site as if I were looking for an ordinance for the city of Winona, for example. How would I go about finding that? Just wanted to see how easily that works.
I'm assuming we're talking about a silica sand ordinance
here.
Yep,
that's right.
So I would click on the silica sand navigation. And we have an ordinance library listed here. So the default brings up all of the ordinances. We didn't want to single out one ordinance over another, so the original list that's right here is all of them. And so we're looking for something from Winona, you said?
Yep.
Right there in the bottom. See it.
I wanted to search for it because I want to see how it searches. Please, Mr. Chair. If it's not too much trouble.
Just wanted to. I'll show you that I can read from this one.
You're going down.
Oh, wow.
Commissioner, it brings up five different options that we have to look at from the city of Winona.
So, Megan, had the chair's prerogative been taken, he might have seen only one ordinance that was available. But because we utilized the search function, we actually found five. How interesting.
Totally
how interesting.
Well done.
Thank you.
Well done, both of you. Other questions for Megan? Seeing none. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll just chime in here, too. I mean, it's no secret that across the enterprise, small boards and commissions struggle with procuring enough support for IT. And so I just want to, you know, thank the MPCA and the Minute team here for working with us on this. A couple noteworthy items. We're one of the first state agencies that is now on the Drupal platform for content management. What that means is it's designed to be a very user-friendly platform so that we don't need to rely on IT staff to make every single change. And so it allows us to manage it more in-house and makes it more sustainable in an effort to really get around having to find additional resources to do all things IT. So.
All right. Thank you again. Let's move then to the next item on the agenda, Building Efficiencies presentation, the Department of Commerce. And I'd like to welcome from the Department of Commerce, Janet Streff. Welcome, Janet.
Good afternoon. Good
afternoon.
Good to be here. I'm going to talk today about building efficiency, and Megan said a little bit ago that she said as CZO comes to an end, and I must admit I breathed a sigh of relief. I'm not sure I agree that that's the case, but staff and state agencies have been working hard this last year on CZO, and I think some good things have come of it and will continue to come of it. One of the things that has come of it was PCA staff working with Georgetown Climate Center to look at the resiliency of buildings in Minnesota and could improvements be made on them. And Will thought that it would be a good bookend to have a bit of a discussion on some of the policy options that we looked at CZO, specifically one that looked at how do we get to a net zero energy building in Minnesota? What would it take? And what does this take right here? There, good. So the overview is first talking to you a little bit about a program that we've had for some time, Minnesota Sustainable Buildings 2030, SB 2030. And then I want to go into something that's happening in the here and now at the University of Minnesota, talk a little bit about the recommendations that we did with CZO, and then hopefully tee it up for Sarah from the Georgetown Climate Center. We've been working towards net zero for a long time. And I've been in state government for a long time because I was there in 2001 when the legislation was passed. Senator Kelly was instrumental in getting that started, requiring us to first benchmark all public buildings and then to develop sustainable building design guidelines for all public buildings that got state bond funds. Commerce did this in cooperation with the Department of Administration, and we still work very closely as a team and as a team, we've met our goals. In 2004, we did get the benchmarking system developed and started, although it took much longer to benchmark all public buildings than we had anticipated. And the design guidelines were developed. In 2009, however, the sustainable building component came into it, and the legislature said, we want you to create an energy standard that will help us get to a net zero by 2030. Architecture 2030 is a national standard and initiative that is really trying to get all architects and engineers and buildings down to a net zero by 2030. So we started. And I guess I would want to say, as we developed all of this and hired our folks to put these programs into place, from the beginning, and we interviewed teams that were international, but we chose a Minnesota team made up of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota, admin, and two private sector, the White Group, who does modeling for energy, and an architect, LHB Architects. And I have to say, from 2001 to today, they've continued to be part of that team and have given more, I think, than they've been paid. They had a vision and really have helped us bring it together. So they helped us put the energy standard together, and in 2010, we set this benchmark, and we said, 2010, you have to be 60% less than that benchmark. And we started down that road, and buildings started to be designed to do that. Just this year, in 2015, we're going another 10%. So the bonding bills that are happening as of 2015, the energy standard will make them that much more efficient. The program requires this, as I said, of all buildings that get state bond funds at this point. They're new or substantially renovated, so if they're over 10,000 square feet or if they have big mechanical systems, then they have to look at meeting the standard. And so far, they're doing pretty well. I think that's in part because the SB 2030 program is also requiring them to have education. We're training the architects and engineers. The University of Minnesota has several programs that they've started and put into place. And then the other thing that we've done in conjunction with it that was required is, you know, we're getting the cycle, is that we build buildings to a good standard, then we benchmark them, and we continue to take care of our buildings. And so we are developing a pretty substantial operations program as well. There's a pilot going on that the Real Estate and Construction Division at Admin is leading. But we really see that all facility managers should be able to put that into place. So they put all their data into this program, and it calculates an energy standard, and then starts the energy modeling. How are you going to build this building? What components are needed to reach that 70% of the goal? And they finally get down to it. I want to say 78 buildings have now been designed through the program. 88% of all the buildings have reached the goal that's been set. And, you know, some have had a little bit more trouble. You know, I want to say, just even on the Capitol complex, one of the buildings that's always been has used more energy is the health building, because of the different kinds of equipment that they have. So there are different reasons for why a building may or may not reach that goal. But substantially, they are all reaching it. I was looking for my website. The website is b3mn.org, and I want to say that you might want to visit it is because they have some really good case studies that along with the 78 buildings that were designed to the SB 2030 standard, we had these sustainable design, building design guidelines since 2004. So we've been doing case studies on those as well. And they're showing how much did this building, how much energy does it save, how much emissions are reduced, and what is the cost, first the estimate, but then what did it cost to build? We're finding that it's pretty equal. It's not costing a great deal, if anything, more to build these buildings this way. So I wanted to, you probably all read the Star Tribune about a week ago on the back side of the business section on a Friday, but the University of Minnesota Cold Climate Housing Center, the guy there, Pat Hellman, has been working on residential buildings, making them more efficient, making them safer, making them more resilient. He was there when I started. And he's, for the past several years, has taken a group of students to a U.S. Department of Energy design competition. And last year they did pretty well. Well, this year they beat out 33 teams from 27 universities. And this was called the Race to the Zero Competition. Their task was to design a house that would offset all or most of its annual energy consumption. And that it doesn't offset, then you use some renewable energy to make it net zero. So they won. They were hoping to have them contribute to our Eco Experience exhibit. We started with them last year to show how to design wall structures for a home in a way that could meet net zero. I don't know whether these kids are going to be there or not. Students were there last year with their designs. So it's something that they're learning right now, and they're going to be putting into practice because it just makes sense and they know how to do it. It's pretty exciting. Another thing I think interesting about this design is that they developed it so that it could fit into a small lot, in a city small lot. So they've been working with a group called Urban Homeworks. I think they're planning to build some of these that could be purchased from some low-income families. It's here right now and can be done. So that brings me to CZEO. And a year ago when we started this effort and what could we do that could make more buildings more energy efficient more quickly, we thought, let's see if the policy would make sense to start a requirement to do this. And working with other state agency folks, we did. We thought, okay, what would it be like if we required all commercial buildings were required to use SB 2030 by 2020? We said, how about residential buildings by 2025? And then we knew we'd have to do the training, much like we had done with SB 2030. So we thought, well, it's, you know, 2030 is right around the corner when you start to get down to it. So how could we still step it and still reach our goal? So we thought, what if we work with the Department of Labor and Industry Building Codes and Standards Division, and they were on our team and certainly support some of these codes changes, that they said we could adopt this code as an appendix. It wouldn't need to go through the legislature. They have the ability to adopt appendix chapters. So we thought, let's set that up, and then cities could adopt it if they chose and have the commercial buildings or residential buildings in their city do it. We also thought, let's make SB 2030 mandatory for all public buildings, not just those that get bond funds. And then in 2020, we thought that gives us a little bit of time. Then we'd set the mandatory, and that, of course, would need to be through legislation. Residential, we took a similar tact, except we knew we were going to have to develop our energy standard that the White Group has helped us, the software, because we're going to have a lot more entities coming and using that software. So we knew we needed a little bit of time with that. But in the interim, again, we'd work with Dolly to adopt an appendix chapter so that there'd be a stretch code that cities could do. This is all a great move away from the prescriptive codes of today to a performance code. Here's this number that you have to reach. How can you best build it? And with what materials so that you get the energy efficiency? So we checked the policy option, we wrote it, gave all sorts of data to the Climate Center for Climate Strategies, and these were the estimated savings that came from that recommendation. It was, I don't think, quite the highest. I think increasing the renewable energy standard, I think, came up before it, but it was very near the top, that making our buildings more efficient, using less energy and supplementing it with renewable energy just makes sense. It's going to reduce emissions. It's going to save money.
Can you go back, Janet, real quick to that slide? And just a little bit of context. That first column, that 9.29 number, that's almost 20% of where we need to be per the statutory requirement. So it's a pretty significant bite out of our goal.
That's a big bite.
The TG, I looked at that. TG is teragrams, meaning 1 million metric tons. So it is a lot of carbon, and it's the carbon equivalent. California is the only other state, or is the only state, I guess I would say right now, who has had law in place requiring their buildings to get down to a net zero. They started quite a few years ago. They have always had a strong energy code, Title 24, and they, instead of going on a performance route, have kept changing their Title 24 code, and then they'd have to meet that, and then they change it again. And so they've gone through a lot of adoptions. So I know that 2030 is coming. I haven't seen lately where they are in their goal, but it's in statute, so I'm sure somebody is sweating that one out right now. So how does zero net energy come into resiliency? And I'm sure Sarah's going to talk a lot more about resiliency, but one thought I had is when I did start, my first career was in construction management in California with Title 24, and then I came here and worked in codes again, and was working when we first knew we had to make our buildings more have better ventilation. And we did that. And a part of that came to be law because the builders said, okay, we'll ventilate it more, but we also want to make sure that our buildings are durable. And so that's been in our statute for some time, is we want to think about how do we build the buildings to last a long time. And so I think resiliency, whether it's because of climate or something else, is a goal that we hold high right now, and I think thinking about it in terms of climate is just another lens that we should actually look at. So, you know, we've done benchmarking, the sealed and insulated building envelope, as I said, the performance code allows us to choose what works best, and ZNE and resiliency. We need to use as little energy as we can and then supplement it with renewable energy. But as Pat Hellman and his team have shown us, it's here and it's now. So it's exciting.
Thank you very much, Janet. Excellent presentation. Questions for Janet?
You will mention to my commissioner who came to hear me, I thought.
Well, I was wondering, did you organize that where you had a strategically placed call that removed him from you? Yeah, I would have done it, yeah.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair, thank you. How does the renewable energy piece fit in with the building net zero? How does that
Sure. I think currently folks see solar energy mm-hmm. probably as the easiest distributed generation to use. And really, the first, as always, is making your home as efficient, so you're using as little energy as possible. Before, when large wind farms are working, can you buy enough wind and do a trade-off? I think we're going to go through phases like that as well, mm-hmm. and that may be how some people say they're in a net zero building.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Other questions,
Chair? Could you go back to the table from the CZO report, that one? So just walk me through the cost effectiveness number there on the far right-hand columns, just by virtue of what the savings, what that means if this strategy were to be implemented, because I think that's really one of the other key, not only the teragrams of greenhouse gas emissions reduced, but the actual the economy of this would be really important, just to remind us about.
Well, and I might ask Will or Anna to also help me out with this. I love words much more than numbers. And my wishes.
Anna. is Anna's command, evidently, yes.
Welcome, Anna.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Janet, for the presentation. So what this is showing is that in the time between 2015 and 2030, and the schedule that Janet showed, most of those changes are actually happening towards the very end of that. So in residential, the changes don't really even start until 2025. But that cumulative savings of money, and it's a net societal savings, would be $2 billion. And that is mainly coming from offset of energy that you no longer need to use because your building is so efficient. And this is consistent with energy efficiency studies and also what has been demonstrated in the field around the country. So the next column, the cost effectiveness, is how much it costs per a ton of CO2. So here it's actually a saving. So you're saving $33 per a ton of CO2 that you reduce. So the societal cost of CO2, the EPA puts it somewhere around $30 a ton. And this is actually saying that you save that much money. And so from CZO, just to put it in context, in general, the energy efficiency policies have a net saving. So you're reducing emissions and you're saving money. And that is not true for all of the things that we want to do to reduce emissions. So this is really the kind of win-win best case of there's an economic opportunity and a climate opportunity.
Thank you.
And to add on to that, we're supposed to get back our macroeconomic results over the next month, and I think it's pretty intuitive that the jobs numbers will be very large for these strategies because these are very labor-intensive policies.
So one more question for Will, I think. What do you think the uptake by local governments who own and construct facilities? I mean, I heard what you had to say, Janet, about the code, voluntary code adoption, but where's the state at in terms of local government adoption of this practice for their facilities?
Will or Jen?
Or any of you?
I know that the city of St. Paul right now requires its buildings to be built to SB 2030. There have been several other cities that have looked at it. I know the Green Step Cities members. There are several of those that not have signed on, but have seen that it's a good way to go. So I think we would have looked at the Green Step Cities as a list of cities to first look at using it as an appendix chapter to their code. St. Louis Park, perhaps, who's been pretty progressive in that area.
Mr. Chair, I just bring it up because it seems like a great opportunity as municipal infrastructure and facilities age and there's going to be renewal of that infrastructure. That's a great opportunity for local units of government to reduce their cost of operations going forward, and that would be a huge opportunity missed for the greenhouse gas emission reductions as well as their own economic interests.
Kate?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate the presentation. My question is, and I don't know if it's for you or for the next presenter, but I've been involved a little bit with the energy thinking at the redevelopment up at the Rice Creek Commons, or the formerly known as the TCAP site. And then there's the Ford plant site, and then the Umore down in Rosemont. So there's some really big kind of starting from below the ground with infrastructure and building redevelopment opportunities, and they're actually very quite forward-looking on energy and resilience. And I'm curious how much they've been engaged with the CZO process and what kind of dialogue is happening with the people who are leading, who are working on these different redevelopment projects around the Twin Cities.
Got it.
I don't know how much the CZO discussion has been involved, but certainly the SB 20 getting down to a net zero has. My boss, Bill Grant, certainly is on the Ford team looking at what can be done. Staff, including Richard Graves, who's executive director over at the Center for Sustainable Building Research, is involved. So I think there's some pretty good communication going on there. They try and keep.
Is that for the Ford plant site? How about the Rice Creek Commons?
I don't know about that one.
Okay.
I just want to thank Janet for all the hard work that her team does. She does, and focused on the buildings and all of the energy stuff in our energy office. So we have a terrific staff, and I just want to applaud them for all their great work that they do.
Thanks.
Sorry you missed a really good report.
I've read it. I know what it's about. I'm very happy to, and had to answer a higher call for a minute there. So. Anyway, great work.
Other questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you very much, Janet. And as you said, this is a great segue into the next presentation, building efficiency presentation by our friends from Georgetown Climate Center. And welcome, Sarah Culverter.
Afternoon, everybody.
Afternoon.
And just a little bit of context for the board, too, as the final, you know, the final numbers from CZO get digested, we're going to try and, over the course of the year and kind of going forward, try and use our board meetings to highlight individual policies similar to this to really showcase how we're moving forward and where there are opportunities.
Sarah, maybe I could have you introduce yourself and your partner.
Sure. Maybe I'll introduce Sarah. I'm Laura Milberg with the MPCA Sustainable Development Unit. In late 2013, the Georgetown Climate Center put out a call for proposals for in-kind assistance. And so our climate adaptation team responded with a proposal to look at the preemptive state building code and how that might affect local government's abilities to adapt to the changing climate. We were awarded that, and so history was made. And now Sarah's here to present the report we collaborated on.
Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'll try to live up to history. Wasn't prepared for that. I'm Sarah Hoverter with Georgetown Climate Center, and thank you so much for having me, and thank you to Janet for such a nice teeing me up presentation. So I've been asked to talk a little bit today about not just energy efficiency, but building resilience broadly in the state of Minnesota as it relates to building codes. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the intersection of climate adaptation and building codes in Minnesota. For those of you who don't know Georgetown, we are a program at Georgetown Law School. So I am a lawyer. You should know I'm coming at this from a law and policy perspective and not a science or design perspective. We work with state and local governments all over the country on various climate adaptation and mitigation issues. And I am our sort of urban person. I work on both urban heat islands and green infrastructure. So I came to this really thinking about the ways in which local governments can use their codes to make good things happen, and the ways in which states can support that. So I'm going to take 2 seconds to just talk about impacts, because I know you all have seen these slides probably a million times before, but to relate them to buildings specifically. This is from the 2013 Risky Business Report and represents 2 timescales for average summer temperatures for Minnesota, the first of which is 2020 to 2039, and the second of which is towards the end of the century. And I don't think I probably need to spell that out for you. The numbers and the colors kind of speak for themselves. Things are going to get hotter, which is, of course, the most intuitive change that we all expect with climate change. Layering that on top of the challenges that Minnesota already faces, though, make things a little more interesting. This graphic from the Global Cool Cities Alliance shows that Minneapolis-St. Paul is actually one of the most intense urban heat islands in the country right now, before we get to climate change. So keeping in perspective that whatever anybody might think about climate change, heat waves and intense heat are extremely dangerous and are extremely bad for building efficiency. So keeping in mind, even right now, particularly within your larger urban areas, you're going to want to think about some changes. Related, of course, is that people die when it gets hot. Global Cool Cities Alliance, again, did some research in D.C., L.A., and New York City, looking at a 10% increase in surface reflectivity and vegetation and what that would do for both temperatures and for heat-related mortality. The numbers are pretty startling. You know, 0.3 degrees Fahrenheit for New York doesn't sound like a lot, but it leads to a 9% reduction in mortality, which is really pretty astounding. So this is pretty important, both for buildings and for human beings. Of course, flooding as well. These are actually historic changes in precipitation in Minnesota, and even if you just project out past changes, there's a lot more water coming in and a lot more intense pieces. This is 2012 in Duluth. I'm sure you all remember this quite well. Heavy downpours are expected to increase significantly over the next few decades. You're going to get a lot more rain in the spring and in intense bursts, less rain in the summer, which is obviously going to have some serious impacts for agriculture in the state and the economy. But beyond that, for buildings, this kind of water in people's houses and in commercial developments and in industrial areas is very bad. You're going to have to deal with not only sort of people relocating, with rebuilding, with recovery, but with the things that water carries with it when it comes into people's homes and the mold that results afterwards after there's been water in someone's house, which is a pretty serious public health problem as well. So what do you do about it? Well, that's where the building code piece comes in. And this schematic is from the New York City Building Resiliency Task Force report that came out last year. For building stock, it means that increases in temperatures are going to mean increased energy use, at least for those buildings that have got air conditioning, which is obviously not what we're looking for these days. In terms of resilience otherwise, there are a number of interventions that codes can support, including cool roofs, including operative windows, which you would be surprised how much a difference it can make just to have windows that open to get some cross breeze in a place. And including things like sewage valves to prevent sewage backups in basements when you do have intense flooding. So communities across the country are making these changes. In addition to New York City, which has implemented several land use and building code changes post-Sandy, LA in 2013 passed an ordinance, their city council, requiring all new residential development to have a cool roof. Which, of course, being light-colored, reflects energy and keeps both interior and exterior temperatures cooler. In case you think this is something that would only fly in California, Dallas, Texas, believe it or not, also has an element in its green building ordinance requiring cool roofs on commercial buildings. So, and for those of you who live in places where the roofs are not flat and made of concrete, cool roofs come in all kinds now. So, we sort of came in and looked at Minnesota's building code to see what kind of options Minnesota local governments might have to try to increase resilience in their buildings. And we looked at a number of incentive-based and other voluntary measures such as benchmarking and development incentives, expedited permitting, tax incentive, those kinds of things. Because, as all of you know, Minnesota's state code precludes any local codes from being different from the state code for any reason other than local geographic conditions. So the ability of a local government here in the state to be able to require something like a cool roof or other resilience elements is extremely limited. We also took a look at some models from other states. And we put those models on sort of a spectrum of more state control to less state control over local codes. And you'll notice that nobody's way over on the right. We didn't go look at anybody who was too crazy. But we tried to take a look at some of the other state models where locals have some flexibility and some opportunity to differ based on local conditions and local needs, while the state still retains control so that they don't do something crazy. And I should state before I explain each of the state models that in all of these states, the state code applies statewide unless and until a local government takes action to make something different, and that that state code is always a floor. Locals are allowed to be more stringent, but they can't undermine the standards that the state code has set. So, for example, in Massachusetts, local governments are able to apply to the state code commission for permission to change their code specifically for accounting for climate change, actually, or other special local conditions, only to be more restrictive than the state code, as I said before. State retains the right to deny that change if they think it's insufficiently justified or out of line with uniformity across the state by too much. Massachusetts, I should say, has also developed a stretch energy code that they offer as an alternative for locals to be able to adopt should they choose to. Pennsylvania and California, local governments can amend their codes to account for particular local conditions, including local climatic, geological, and topological conditions. And actually, in Pennsylvania, they add public health and safety as well. California, local governments have to notify the state and can be denied permission to amend their codes in the particular way that they want to if they have not shown sufficient justification to do it. In Pennsylvania, it's only subject to review by the state if somebody challenges it. And at that point, it's subject to review by the state and then potentially disapproval. Washington State, local governments can amend their codes simply by notifying the state government, with the exception of residential codes where there is a review process at the state level. So is there chaos in all of these other places? Not so much. I wanted to show you quickly what it looks like where I'm from, in the National Capital Region, which includes three sort of states, if you count the district, which for building code purposes is a state. You've got, within a 20-mile radius of the White House, two states, well, three states if you count the district, several counties and a whole bunch of municipalities that have their own codes. In the state of Maryland, the state building code is just a starting point. Locals can amend their codes as they wish, and they do regularly. The only exception is that the 2015 International Energy Conservation Code and the Maryland Accessibility Code for ADA purposes are mandatory. So on the spectrum that we just looked at a moment ago, Maryland would be a little farther to the right of the other models. In the district, they have quite strong building code regulations. There isn't really a state-local conflict issue there particularly, so I didn't put it on the spectrum that I'll show you in a moment. But in Virginia, they have a statewide code much like Minnesota's. It applies uniformly statewide, the end. So you would think perhaps that there isn't a lot of development in those places where the building code is more restrictive, right? You'd think that developers would choose to go elsewhere. And in fact, it's not true. In the district, there's a crane almost every block right now. There's just an astounding amount of development going on. And we have builders that build in multiple counties, multiple towns, multiple states, and they all seem to figure it out. So as I've said before, Maryland is a little bit to the right. Virginia would be pretty far to the left, and the district doesn't really fit particularly. But I just wanted to sort of show that there are a lot of other state models out there where the state retains control over the locals doing something completely crazy and maintain a very solid floor to keep things both safe and resilient. and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Questions?
Where'd you say Minnesota would be on it, sir?
I'm sorry?
Where did you say Minnesota would be on that spectrum?
Oh, on the spectrum? So probably pretty far to the left. Left of Massachusetts, for sure.
Other questions?
And left is a non-political term in this sense, I should say.
North Dakota, I presume, would be on the far right.
You know, I haven't looked at North Dakota, but I can.
Take it to the bank.
Kate?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about how you've shared this information and where this report is available. I have groups that I want to share it with. Maybe they already have heard of it, but I'm just curious how this has been released.
So it's on the MPCA website. I believe it's on the Georgetown Climate Center website as well. I can send you the URL for that, although you can get it at MPCA already. So yeah, it's publicly available. It's for absolutely anybody who is interested.
Other questions? If not, thank you for, I hope, did you fly in specifically for this report today?
For a host of meetings that Laura has set up.
All right. Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to be here, and Laura, thank you for escorting Sarah here today. Let's then move to the last presentation, Eric and Anna. Oh, and Weston, I'm sorry, yeah. This is the Water Report Overview and Work Plan. Welcome, all three of you. I don't know which one. Eric, are you starting?
Anna.
Anna starting? Okay.
Chair and members of the board, my name is Anna Henderson. I'm EQB staff, and I'm going to provide an overview of the EQB five-year water report that's due to the legislature this fall. The report is required by the legislature, so they are our primary audience. But the form of the report is designed to be accessible for all interested parties, including local units of government and interested citizens. I'm just going to take a moment to go over the statutory requirements for the report. So the statute calls for assessments that agencies do that be packaged with the EQB report. These are really standalone reports that are done independently by those agencies, and they're working on those currently. The part of the report that EQB is really facilitating and taking responsibility for and working on and the focus is the policy requirements. And so here there's a long list of all the different things that are listed in the statute. There's a lot of things, and they're kind of disparate. And I just wanted to highlight one piece of the statute, which says this list is not intended to restrict the areas of responsibility to only those specified. So we've taken those to heart. And I'll go through our kind of process for how we've taken that to get to where we're headed to. So the criteria that we're using for what should go in this report is we wanted to focus on policy areas that are cross-cutting through agencies, so they really require some interagency dialogue. We wanted to highlight areas that are timely for discussion or that haven't had a lot of discussion yet. And we wanted to build on existing agency work to help shine a light on key findings, programs, or success stories. So it's not going to be comprehensive of everything about water. The ultimate goal is that this be an agenda-setting document that's broadly accessible. And to do that, our format is to take a lot of complex information from very long reports and digest it into something that's accessible and relatively short. So about 32 pages, you have to work in units of four. And that we want to be telling the picture, the story with pictures and with plain language. And when we think about plain language, we've been working with the DNR communications team, and they've been really educational. But we're not just thinking about our word choices, but also the way in which we show the report, the form, how much text is on the page, the way that we show graphics. So the workflow, the process that we are in, we had that really long list of all the things plus anything else that we could think of about water that this would cover. So we started by having conversations with the interagency coordination team on water and the interagency groundwater team. And then we met with leadership teams from all of the agencies to talk to them about what they saw as the key issues in water that needed more discussion and what they thought were ways that we could bend the curve. What are the solutions that are out there? And we took all of those conversations and we wrote up notes in all sorts of Excel spreadsheets to compare what everybody had brought up and what were different ways that we could frame this. And we took it and made a straw proposal, and then we took that to an interagency team of staff that we've formed. And so when I first made this picture here, I actually took pictures of wheels. And Weston has more design sense than me, and he made it look a little bit simpler. But we really think of these interagency staff as it's kind of a they're the hub, and they reach out to everybody at their agencies. And so they're coming to weekly meetings with us or communicating with us, but they're really connecting us to everybody else at their agency. So the role of those interagency staff members is that they're representing their agency to the group on policy. They're participating in these interagency discussions, sometimes debates, but they're always pretty friendly, maybe they're too friendly, on water policy and the content of the report. And then within their own agency, they're connecting all the right experts to us. They're contributing data and some very concise writing, and they're communicating with their leadership. Just wanted to, you have in your board packet the roster of those interagency staff. And I just want to note that there are a lot more people who are contributing to the report through those hubs from your agencies. The overall structure for the report is that we have a set of purpose statements, and under each of those, we have two goals. And under those goals, we have what we're thinking of as four buckets for solutions or strategies or ways to bend the curve. And these buckets are the way that we think about how we can take action. And we're not planning to say, here's a problem, and we think you should do this solution that's in this bucket. We really want to just provide, here's the range of ways that we might address it. So we're going to fill all of those buckets. And the way that we're thinking about this is that voluntary strategies are actions by private citizens or businesses or local units of government that they learn about through incentive programs or education. Regulatory, we were talking today that this maybe needs to also be statutory, that it's requirements that are enforced. When more study is needed, that's areas where we don't have enough information to really take action or evaluate. And I just wanted to give an example that has come up in almost every single meeting we've had on this report, which is that we know the science on a lot of this. We know why things are happening, we know what we can do to fix it, and what we don't know is the social science. So we don't know how to make the cultural changes or how to get the pertinent information to people in a way that is meaningful to them and has an impact. System change, hopefully that doesn't sound too ambiguous, but we're thinking about this in terms of changes in management. So one watershed, one plan is an example of that, where you change the way that you go about doing something. And another one that has had a lot of discussion is market-based solutions. So the idea that there are some changes that are going to be made through the private sector and through decisions that private citizens make when they're spending their consumer dollars. And so if there are ways that we can help support that. This is my last slide before we go over to Weston, but this just lays out the very, very broad overview of the report, and this is in the board packet, and hopefully you all got it when you came in. But the first purpose statement is to manage our lands to reduce impacts on water quality and quantity. Underneath this, there are two goals that we're focusing on. One is the need for living cover to protect water, and the other is the need to manage our built environments to protect water quality from runoff and contaminants. These are really broad, and we have more focused areas that we are working on underneath them for what we're actually going into that we've come to through those interagency conversations. Underneath, I have just a selection of solutions. These are just examples to show the types of things that we might have in those buckets. The second purpose statement is to adaptively manage within our natural limits. And so this is taking into account that our populations are growing, our consumption of groundwater is growing, and we only have a certain amount of groundwater, and we don't necessarily always know what that is. And we also have the stress of increased temperatures. And so how do we manage for that kind of water stress? How do we work with that? The second goal under there is to ensure that our infrastructure and ecosystems are resilient to floods and extreme rain events. So again, this is within our natural limits. So if we're going to have extreme rain, that's something we can't do anything about, and we need to figure out how to be resilient to it. So I'm going to turn things over now. Oh, sorry, there's a timeline. So we are hoping to have this put together and have content review by the agencies and leadership in July. We're hoping to leave a lot of time for this, so hopefully that'll happen. Our ideal would be that it's all ready for board approval at the August board meeting, and then we submit it to the legislature September 15th.
Wonderful. Thank you, Anna and Chair Fredrickson. Very pleased to be here today to share the economic section of this report. As Anna queued up real nicely, and you can see on this graph, the economic section is the blue section. It's both a part of the larger water quantity and quality study and a standalone document that will actually be a little lengthier in its standalone form. So this report represents the economic section, the most comprehensive review of the size, scope, and composition of the water industry in Minnesota. Specifically, we're going to take a look at trends in employment, in wages, in payroll, in trade and exports, patents, innovation, as well as opportunities to improve the quality of the institutions that support Minnesota's water cluster. The metrics you can see up here are very similar to an initiative we did with the help of EQB and Department of Ag and Department of Commerce and LEC back in October, which is the Minnesota Clean Energy Economy Profile. We were able to share that with you guys last year. Very similar metrics, and we also kind of see similar outcomes coming from this project. What we want to be able to do is inform elected officials and the public of the significant economic impact of the water industry on the state, as well as benchmark, where able, that industry to other states. We want to catalyze industry involvement. That means prompting conversations, having those industry folks build networks and found and fund institutions that support clusters. And this all kind of comes to the idea, too, of finding opportunities through this report, finding opportunities for industry and nonprofits and government agencies and elected officials to form coalitions that support policies that help the water industry grow. Quickly go over the scope of the research. We're going to take a regional perspective, so we'll have employment, wage, payroll data down to each of the seven regional planning regions in the state. We're going to do that, do the change in employment and wages and investments, patents and exports over time. Depending on the data source, that'll be somewhere around 10 to 15 years. We're going to do public and private sector with one major caveat. In the public sector, we will not include state employment or federal employment in the water industry, and that goes to some methodological issues. And we're also scoping out what the water industry actually means. And for our definition, and we can get into that if you guys have questions on that, but for our definition, we mean water utilities. And this is water, wastewater facilities, stormwater facilities, water products, membranes, filtration, chemicals used for water treatment. You know, your GEs, your Ecolabs would fall under this bucket. Water infrastructure and management. This goes to construction of irrigation systems, pipes, pumps. You have companies like 3M and Pentair in this space. And water efficiency, so monitoring and control technologies, low-flow nozzles fall into this grouping. There are some other areas that, of course, fall out of here, and I can kind of tell you what's in, what's out if you have specific questions, but there are some groups that will fall out, and we kind of consider that in our water-enabled industries, and we'll leave that aside, but we'll address that a little bit in the report itself. Method to hit this at a very high level, we'll have the same method that we used in the clean energy economy profile. This is a very, very conservative method for counting employment, but one we feel very comfortable with. We're working with a consultant, and one of the things we kind of joke about all the time is we only count employers that we can see. We only shoot what we can see, essentially, is the idea. We make sure that we are actually counting water employment, and if not, it doesn't get counted at all. We'll do this through administrative data sets, some manual reviews of industry codes that are often related to the water industry, and we'll also conduct and are conducting presently a survey to count employment in large companies. Wages will pull in from Deeds Unemployment Insurance Record Database, which is the official record of all wages paid by companies to employees over a longitudinal period. It's about 30 or 40 years of data that we have available. We'll only do about 10 or 15, though. And the last section, trade, talent, innovation, supporting institutions, workforce, that grouping is going to come from some proprietary databases that we have access to, some previous research, and expert interviews. The timeline for all of this is the survey will wrap up, and that really concludes our employment study. We'll wrap up on May 29th. We have our link to the water survey, and I've been pushing this hard the last couple weeks. If you know any water companies, let them have the survey so we can count their employment. The economic research will finish on June 30th, and we'll have a document released probably sometime in late summer, perhaps to coincide with a DEED Greater MSP University of Minnesota Water Summit on water tech. So that would be a great release point for us. But then we'll also release it, of course, as part of the broader water quality and quantity study. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's it.
I think. Questions? John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Weston, I had a question. The Great Lakes, the Council of Great Lakes Governors has undertaken a process to describe the water economy of the Great Lakes. It's called Blue Water Accounting. I don't know if that's something that you've looked at yet, but in that report, their goal is to describe the economic indicators across the Great Lakes regionally. What I'm interested in is whether or not, and this isn't, I'm not actually looking for an answer, I just think it would be helpful to the governor to have comparable statistical information relative to that report that they'll put out so that because they're looking at the Great Lakes economy as the watershed of the Great Lakes, which isn't all of Minnesota. But as we think about these regions, I noticed you had some regional indicators in your outline. I just think it would be helpful to try to focus or at least think ahead as your report is prepared for that. I would imagine you'll get the question at some point, how do we plug the data that is brought forward in this report to that blue water accounting system that the Council of Great Lakes Governors is working on? So just a heads up to look at that if you haven't checked that out yet.
That's wonderful. I really appreciate that.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I'm curious on these. You have these three buckets that you've put the purpose in, how to manage the land or the quality, and then how to manage the water itself, and then the economics of the business. Where are the people in this? Where are the impacts on the lives of people, on the lives of communities? And particularly as I look around the state, that how you handle the water will affect different communities differently, and how it'll affect people within those communities, different populations within that differently. It'll impact their economic development, it'll impact their quality of life, and it'll impact their health. Why is that not one of those buckets that is part of this water plan?
Yeah.
So we've been thinking about that, and in our outline, our very messy outline, we have a section for health, human health, and for ecosystem health. And so that is part of the information that we're putting together for the report. And I guess what I would say is that it doesn't show up in this very broad overview because it's just looking at these solutions, but the reason for doing a lot of those is because of concerns for human health and our economies. So, for example, something like the nitrate levels in wells is data that we've been looking at and are planning to put in here. And so the one of the concerns for having excess nutrients that run off our different lands into groundwater or surface water is if they're getting into wells and what that means for human health.
And I'm just wondering, or even included in some of these categories, particularly the equity issues that is going to be impacted by a lot of these things.
Do you have any suggestions?
You know, one, just to start thinking about how it's going to be incorporated, and one, either having a separate bucket, or see how you could include some of the impacts in these areas by themselves.
So it doesn't show up in here because this is really like the 100,000-foot view, but it is in here. So something that isn't on there is that we're looking at wellhead protection areas, but Department of Health is an active part of the team, and we've been working with them, and they're in as part of all the conversations and for where this is going. But it doesn't show up from the level of information that you have in front of you.
Your approach is consistent with the One Health approach, correct? And so that
exactly. And I'm also, I mean, and I know, you know, when we put these things together at a high level, there's usually going to be some communities that are affected more than others, and and we look at the average and we forget about the standard deviation, and we want to make sure that we, you know, we really don't have a plan that looks really good, but some people really suffer because of it, that they're not considered, and we don't have the equity issues built into that kind of conversation.
Can you go back to managing our land to reduce impacts on water quality and water quantity? I assume that if One Health would fall under the first column.
Because we also have, it's the same thing, the issue with DNR. I mean, the water, how we do it, is going to affect plants and animals. In different ways at different parts, and we have to make sure that our plan recognizes those impacts on humans and other living creatures.
You can go ahead and request the legislature to extend the deadline.
Mr.
Chair, do you want to intervene?
Just a brief comment. It sort of piggybacks on Ed's, and I think I've made this observation before. It's sort of an odd pairing, you know, the sort of water quality, quantity issues that are identified in the first two columns with the economic analysis in the furthest column, because the first two really talk about the availability of good water, and the third column is really about, well, what kind of technologies are we developing to improve water? It doesn't really relate to the quantity and quality of water and the economic uses of water in the state, which might get to things like domestic use or industrial use, agricultural use, pop and beer, food, and things like that. So it's a little different angle on the water industry, if you will, because it's more on the sort of the technology of how to change or improve water rather than a focus on the users of the water that are sort of the beneficiaries of the first two columns. So I get this a little different. I've talked, I think, with Will about that before, but I understand we're looking at statutory obligations as well as some other things. But I think the value of water to the state of Minnesota is extraordinary. I think it goes beyond the industries that are out there to try and improve water quality. I think it's the value to the people and to the industries that use the water.
John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, just in responding to both Commissioner Ellinger and Commissioner Landwehr, the number of topics we could write a report about regarding water in Minnesota is really endless. I mean, and you could take so many different approaches on the subject, and I guess what I would encourage for the future is that the board really step back and early enough think about the scope of what we ought to be talking about in enough time to write meaningful reports that we all can contribute to in ways that we find important, because it isn't easy. I've written a whole bunch of water reports in my career, and all of them are great, but
Of course. Thank you. But there is no limit to how many times you could reevaluate what you've already thought about. And I think that what this tells us is that it is a really important issue. You know, how we account for water, how we are seeing the trends in our state water resources change, and how that impacts people. All very valid issues. We just can't write enough reports at enough time. So I would really say, for the sake of where we're at, a five-year update is where we talk about trends and these sort of situational episodic analyses. And I would really like to step back and have a deeper conversation for the future, so that we're not just sort of choosing, but we're really agreeing on what we all are going to choose. That would be a good thing for us to spend our time on in the future, because it is a really important contribution to, I think, what the legislature constantly redebates. They form and they unform legislative water commissions. They codify and uncodify laws related to water. It's one of the most favorite things to do for our legislature, and I think we don't seize the opportunity well enough as a board to, shape that conversation. So that's my thought on the subject.
Kate?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And mine's a pretty narrow question, but I'm curious about, we have these sort of coming together of increasing climate impact and increasing water, either not having enough of it or having too much of it on the landscape, depending on the time of year and the year. And we also have a water infrastructure is old and not meeting our emerging needs with emerging contaminants and all these sorts of things. So I'm curious where the idea of like the need to update our water infrastructure just combine without climate. Climate adds a whole other element, but there's a whole economic impact and a public budget impact from different kinds of contaminants in water and how we think about climate. And it goes to the health questions very much in terms of the impact on people. And I'm just curious where in that, I think it has economic impacts I'm not quite sure where that would fit. If you could maybe help me walk through something like that. I'm trying to understand this framework more. And that's just an issue that I think is increasing in terms of how we pay for and manage public water cleanup. Where would that fit in here?
Anyone want to tackle that narrowly defined question?
Commissioner, members, what we found with a lot of our discussions with the interagency group is a lot of these issues fall into every goal. And that issue specifically we're focusing on with goal number four, looking at infrastructure, looking at a NOAA study that Minnehaha Creek and the City of Victoria did, looking at what the right size of infrastructure is and how prepared are those cities for that cost-wise and people-wise.
The economic section is also going to take a look, working with the Public Facilities Administration, of the actual investment that we've done in the state over the last five or so years to try and put a number around what the investment has been, with obvious opportunity for other groups to build research on perhaps where it's going. So we'll try and build the frame.
Tom?
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on Commissioner Stein's comment, I think we do this every 5 years by statute, right? So it might be useful 3 years from right now, put a tickler on a calendar and say, let's scope this out a little bit. And 3 years from now.
You're on notice, the 10-year reports in 2020.
We may still be here.
Yeah.
But the other thing is the governor indicated he was going to appoint a water person to advise him. I think if that materializes, we should think about getting that person here at some meeting to talk about some of these very things and plug that person in. What's going on? and the way John was describing how things change so much, I was waiting for him to say it's a very fluid subject, but he never did. So I said it for you, John.
Health department, the epidemiologist would say we are in a very fluid situation. That's the way the health department folks think about that.
Yeah. And this is also pretty, this is the first one of these reports that we've been assigned to do. I think 3 years ago, the statute was amended from it being a biennial exercise to being a five-year exercise. And so this is the first of many to follow. So the other thing, too, to make notice of is that DNR Communications is working with a team of graphic artists to try and make this report look and feel similar to the conservation agenda, similar to our climate change report. I think we more broadly see our role in fulfilling the statutory intent in as being able to provide information in a way that's easily digestible and really easy to understand for average Minnesotans, because there is a wealth of information out there. I think every agency has produced very detailed documents, data, good interagency work. We see the opportunity here as more of a communications piece. And so that's kind of the approach that we're trying to take.
I mean, and I think that's part of the conversation I have about the impact on people, because I think the people who are going to be mostly affected by this are not going to be our usual constituents, the stakeholders that, mm-hmm. that we normally deal with. So we have to, and they will get engaged only if they see themselves in that picture. And I mean, in particular, the people who are usually not at these tables, they need to see themselves. That's how they have to have their input. So if we market it the right way, they have to see themselves, and that's where having that human part, particularly the equity part in this, will bring in a lot more of the audience to give input on than saying, what do we really want to do with our water over the next 50 years?
Other questions? Julie?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question, as Commissioner Landwehr alluded to, the North Dakota, and how are you going to deal with, like, border waters like the Red River and, like, regulatory require water use to be metered so we can better manage the resources? Are you going to share that with North Dakota and have them do the same? I mean, they're different water laws, different. I'm just wondering how you're, if you're dealing, I mean, I know it's a Minnesota plan.
Fair question.
But I'm just curious if you're looking into border water issues.
That falls outside of the scope of things we've narrowed our focus to.
Okay.
Future, okay. Other questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you, the three of you, for your presentation. And again, thank you for everyone for the presentations today. I know that I usually come away with a whole lot more than I leave when I, so added to my education. Sure. Thank you. Other business that needs to come before the EQB board? Seeing none, a motion to adjourn would be in order.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Sure.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Board, or the meeting is adjourned.